You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Welcome, everybody. Please have a seat if you haven't already found a place to sit. Get your coffee or whatever you need. We're starting this session number two today on economic reform. My name is Clifford Gaddy. I'll be moderating the panel. I'm from the Brookings Institution. And you have before you four panelists who are going to talk about the progress of economic reform, or the lack thereof, over these past 20 years that the conference is devoted to. In other words, economic reform, what is the economic picture 20 years after the transition to a market economy? And I guess some of our panelists may even question the title here, whether there was a transition to a market economy. But I'm excited to hear this broad view of the whole region, concentrating for the most part on each individual country, I think setting it to some extent in the context of the neighbors as well as other countries that have undergone these transitions since the fall of the Soviet Union. You have before you, you can see, and I can't, the names of the panelists. They're not in the same order as listed in the program, but I think for the sake of convenience, what we're going to do is simply work from my right, your left, on over here, so David will be last, if that's all right with you.
No, that's not.
Right. You're already set up. Okay, all right. So we'll start with Azerbaijan. That's great. No problem at all. Ingelab will start, and we will proceed with about, well, let me say that we do a maximum of about 12 or 13 minutes. The reason for that is we really want to give all of our panelists an equal chance to present what they have to say, and also have a chance for you in the audience to make your own comments or raise questions to the panelists, and that they have time to respond. So I'm counting on having a half an hour before we have to adjourn at 12:45, because we need to start lunch. So without further ado, let's start and move directly into the first presentation.
Thank you very much. I will be brief. I understand that we have short time. I have the short presentation PowerPoint. You can see some of figures, some of, you know, information on the screen, which will be easy for you to understand Azerbaijan economy profile by now. I have decided to avoid any, you know, dividing into historical period, because we had much more, you know, the talk about different historical period in my country. And I will just focus on economy profile from current perspective, and would provide you some information about what gave us 20 years independence and what was the positiveness and negativeness. So the first slide, which you can see, it's the idea was to provide Azerbaijan economy comparatively to other South Caucasus economies in order to understand what kind of picture we have, which is, I think, reasonable. So it's a picture which provides us the information in terms of GDP per capita dynamics over 20 years, but the statistics was more clearly since 1995. And you can see how it's different Azeri GDP dynamics comparatively to other economies, Georgia and Armenia. And the information, not just mostly, you know, the absolute figure, 7.5 time, but again, comparatively, how is the difference from two other countries, and can you can imagine that it's mostly thanks to oil. So second slide, so provide us the information in terms of GDP portfolio of South Caucasus, and you can see our biggest economy, which is 74% of you know, the whole GDP in the South Caucasus, and again mostly the, you know, the oil and gas, which is the, you know, the substantial part of GDP. And the third graph, you can see it's international reserves in three countries. And it's particularly important because international reserves in Azerbaijan by the early 2011 in Azerbaijan, it's a fantastic figure. It's more than $40 billion, mostly thanks to oil fund, which we have, which by that time had, no, by now had more than $32 billion. So it's also important in terms of, you know, to manage the negative impact from global crisis, in terms of managing sustainability, macroeconomy stability issues, and of course, this factor is very remarkable for our country. So as I mentioned about the oil and oil role in the economy, it would be reasonable to see what kind of share we have in terms of oil role in GDP, in budget revenues, and exports. So as you can see, it's less than 50% of GDP, it's oil. Around 64% budget revenues incoming from oil, mostly from oil fund, but also from oil revenues by foreign and domestic companies. And finally, which is very, you know, the significant and symptomatic picture, it's an export share of oil, which is crude oil plus oil products. Altogether, it's more than 92%. So let's see what gave us 20 years economy independence in terms of positiveness and negativeness. So first, of course, it's a green light on Western capital coming into country. As we signed the oil contracts, main oil contract in 1994, we had most of very important transnational companies like BP, Statoil, ExxonMobil, Total, many others. So from that period, we have more and more capital coming into not just oil sector, but mostly in oil sector. Next positive, it's a substantial reconstruction of the infrastructure. Again, it's thanks to oil, thanks to oil money, and we have really good opportunity to change the face of the economy, the infrastructure of the city particularly. And third point, it's of course the, again, thanks to oil opportunity to change a substantially face of city, face of capital, Baku, and to, which is not just a beautiful city, actually it's the richest city in the world. And finally, through oil and not just oil technology and investment, integration of the economy to world economy, to European economy and management system. So negativeness, yes, we have much more negativeness, particularly is unemployment. You know, it's Azerbaijan economy is very specific economy. It's a labor force is surplus economy, and also oil sector is very specific, which doesn't give the opportunity to have much more value added economy. That's why we have a very big problem with unemployment. Part of these people moved to Russia and other countries, but many of them in the country, they have such kind of troubles, but this is very, really very big challenges for oil economy and for our economy. So next one is a loss of Soviet industry and agricultural sector. Maybe related industry, it seems like not so bad, but it's very bad news that we almost lost our agricultural sector. So partly because of oil specifics like Dutch disease, and partly because of so no effective management on agricultural sector and problem with exchange rate, problem with, you know, the negative needs which had many oil countries in the world. About education system, yes, as you know, we are all post-Soviet countries. We had very robust education system, and actually we have we're starting to see how it's problematic for us, particularly in the provinces, to see less and less educated people, and which is much more, you know, the problematic for society, not just in our country. And the ejection of labor forces, as I mentioned, it's interrelated to unemployment problems. Mostly people move to Russia, and I can say that actually we have roughly around 1.5 million labor force, which is third part of economy active people, who work in Russia, and maybe the positiveness on this factor that they, you know, they have huge remittance for the country, which is line number two after oil revenues, which is very, you know, good compensation for power, for poor people, for provinces, families, and so on. So corruption, we mentioned a lot about it. It's a very big and very how to say, long-termly a really killing problem for our economy and not just for economy. So we understood and we identified that Azeri economy's resource-abundant economy is absolutely different from two other economies. And so as an oil economy, there is, you know, there are some advantages. At the same time, there are some disadvantages. First, we have states' expansion economy like Keynes' approach as those economies. Thanks to this money, we can stimulate economy, we can create, you know, job, we can so do many things thanks to state money, but it's really, I think it works, and it dramatically changed some, you know, the issues in the country. Massive infrastructure, I mentioned about it, and about others, international reserves, and momentumly, you know, the participating in investment abroad, it's our reality. What about disadvantage? It's inflation. People talk about it. It's really a big problem for our country. It's loss of competitiveness. It's much more problematic for us because we have mostly costly and heavy economy. What does it mean? Mostly it's investment from state side, which is corruptive, which is not so effective. There isn't any cost-effective, sometimes cost-effective analysis. That's really a big problem. And also lack of job-created economy and, like, you know, the lack of innovation. Comparatively to other economies, unfortunately, Azeri index of innovation is less, you know, favorable rather than Armenian and Georgian. So two final slides. It's truly sustainable. Mostly, as you can see on the screen, it depends on oil factor. So we have oil, and as far as oil is enough, it will be sustainable, it will be manageable for government, even this is not so effectively in terms of economy management. So as you can see from the focus that it will be as minimum enough to 2025, this is focused not just domestic and government, it's also foreign sources. Oil funds, which will have around $100 billion by 2025, which is equal GDP by that time. Transit resources, as we know, it is also one of the other alternatives. And finally, SOCAR Black Sea investment, which is very important for us because many different, you know, the investment program like Turkey, Georgia, Romania, Ukraine seems very attractive and very, you know, the challengeable. Just we cannot understand, is it really the situation when national oil company, which is SOCAR, becoming to be like Aramco, like, I don't know, Petronas, or we have still have the problem like a less accountable, less transparent companies. And about market economy, yes, we are not WTO member as to other countries in the region. We still have a bigger problem with monopoly barrier on the access of market. We have the problem, contradiction between old and new economy. And the finally, very important issue is we cannot see any separation between business, bureaucracy, and politics. Sometimes it's the one hand, sometimes it's not effective, sometimes it's not competitiveness. So first, it's a conflict of interest. Second, it's, of course, the big problem with for sustainability of economy issue. So final my remark, what kind of picture we have? Really, thanks to oil, we have very, you know, the remarkable and attractive picture in terms of size of economy. But unfortunately, it's not a self-sufficient economy. And I remembered yesterday we had a good presentation from Hans' side. He said that there was a feedback from different, you know, the people in different countries. In Armenia and Azerbaijan, people mostly associated government as a parent. Unfortunately, for our economy, Azeri government as a parent. But again, unfortunately, it's corruptive parents. So this is our challenge. We have to think on that. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Well, it's obvious we're going to let all the panelists present, and then we'll have our discussion. This was wonderful. I think what I'll do now is switch to the order of the program to be somehow consistent. And anyway, it probably is appropriate that we have the presentation on Armenia. I have here to my right, to your left from me, David Grigorian, senior economist at the International Monetary Fund, and the co-founder of Policy Forum Armenia, who is going to give us the picture of what's been happening in Armenia. David, please.
Thank you, Clifford. Let me start by thanking the organizers for allowing this opportunity for me to share my views, much of which is, are based on the product of my own research on Armenia, on macroeconomic conditions in Armenia. Before I start, though, I should make a disclaimer that, that the views expressed here are entirely my own and should not be attributed to organizations I'm affiliated with, either International Monetary Fund or the Policy Forum Armenia. That said, just to give you a sense of where I'm coming from on some of the issues that I'll be raising for your attention is this is not a, a cross-country presentation. The intention here is to compare Armenia's performance to its potential across time. I think this would be the most relevant frame of mind, and I hope you agree with that. While I recognize that there are limitations imposed by geography as well as security in geopolitics, I think there are limits, there are limitations that the policymakers since independence, since 1991, have imposed on policy and economic outcomes that have actually had a much more pronounced impact on those outcomes. So with that caveat, allow me to basically try and fit 20 years of history into, 12, 13 minutes of presentation. It will be a challenge. But to do that, I thought it would be appropriate to break the those 20 years into sort of three periods and just sort of go from there. And I do promise to focus mostly on a final period, which I think is more relevant, not only for understanding where we are, but also for getting a sense of where we're heading from here. So I'd like to sort of break the whole 20 years into the first period, which is the post-transition progress going from 1991 to 99. The second period, which I called qualitative stagnation from year 2000 to 2007. And finally, the sort of 2008 onwards, which I call sort of gradually a hopeless stagnation. And I'll give you a sense of why I'm doing that. You know, allow me to sort of briefly as I can give you a sense of what defines each of those periods, and then I'm happy to take up your questions on the specifics during the Q&A. What was a remarkable return to growth in 1994, actually first among the former Soviet republics, it was achieved during an extremely difficult time, a time that saw sort of a devastating earthquake, a collapse of markets essentially overnight as a result of collapse of the former Soviet Union, and a full-blown war. This was the progress that we saw there was largely underpinned by a successful small and medium enterprise privatization, a land privatization that was unprecedented at that time, but was done with the almost complete disregard of the role of markets and institutions in economic management and outcomes. Of course, the ongoing conflict with Azerbaijan and the legacy of a highly industrialized country that by this time sort of became an obsolete sort of didn't help in that. There were first signs already at that period of sort of nouveau riche concentrating sizable wealth and getting too close for some people's comfort to economic decision making. There were also the seeds of authoritarian governance were sown at that very period. The generals returning from the front lines were getting increasingly powerful and had, by some accounts, played a role in the fraudulent elections in 1995 and 96. So this is where sort of this is a little bit about the 91 to 99 period. The period ended with the assassination of the then Prime Minister Vazgen Sarkisian and six others in the October 27, 1999. A period that is characterized by a very high level of public buy-in in the policies that this particular prime minister had laid out during his prime ministership. The promise, unfortunately, to get the diaspora involved meaningfully at that stage was effectively reversed by the administration that was running the country back then. And Policy Forum Armenia talks about this issue in great detail in its report, sort of that assesses the 20 years of Armenia diaspora in engagement. Then follows the period qualitative stagnation, as I said, from 2000 to 2007, which is characterized by double-digit growth and macro-financial stability. But and there are several buts in this sort of the whole story that I'd like to share. The growth was concentrated largely in construction sector, fueled by remittances, which has absorbed sizable amounts of both credit and labor resources of the economy, pushing both prices, wages, as well as exchange rate up in a classic that Dutch disease case. The fiscal policy was highly pro-cyclical, given the almost double-digit growth. For several years, the budget still ran the deficits for a while. Despite that, the spending on health, education, and public investment were incredibly low. And in fact, Armenia was among the lowest ranked countries measured by the spending on these categories as a percentage of GDP. And I'm talking in the entire developing world, countries with similar per capita levels. My own research with Hamid Davoudi at the Fund, published in 2007, focused on poor revenue performance and reasons behind it. And back then, we estimated that Armenia under-collects systematically about 6.5% of its GDP in taxes, which at that time amounted to about $500 million a year. And we found that the source of that under-collection was mostly the direct taxes coming from shortages in corporate profit tax payments to the budget. There was a failure to diversify the economy, despite a very strong promise offered by some sectors and information technologies and agri-processing, just to name a few. In all fairness, remittances have complicated the economic management and have also created dependence at the micro level. Again, there were issues of policy coordination between the Ministry of Finance and the Central Bank pertaining to handling the remittances flows. The formation of large oligarchic clans with direct ties with and influence over the political economy sort of began taking a shape, became a serious issue at this point. There's growing evidence of the impact of monopoly pricing on economic outcomes. There's a paper published by the World Bank in 2004 that looks at deadweight losses from monopoly pricing in sugar and gasoline markets, and I estimated those losses to be around 3% of GDP annually, and those are huge sums of money. Now, turning to the final stage in this the whole saga, the hopeless stagnation, this period is characterized by political upheavals that followed the events of March 2008 and the impact of the global crisis. I think most observers would agree that the state capture has reached enormous proportions in Armenia. The economy remains highly concentrated in the hands of people directly or indirectly involved in politics. What we saw in 2008 was a poor crisis preparedness and mostly inadequate policy mix with disproportionate reliance on fiscal stimulus funded by external borrowing. Compared to exchange rate and structural policies. Again, these issues are highlighted in Policy Forum Armenia's 2008 report on crisis and how to mitigate its implications. There were some attempts made, but in my view, less than fully credible, to raise the level of tax to GDP. I believe much more can be done for Armenia to get there, given the low level of social spending that I highlighted earlier. The fiscal management remains very complicated by the level of and composition of debt, public debt. While mostly on concessional terms, the sovereign debt has reached alarming levels, nearly 50% of GDP, over 90% of which is FX, foreign currency denominated, and in a country where the exchange rate is believed to be highly overvalued. This is a problem. The repayment profile of that debt is also worrisome. The real GDP has not reached the 2007 levels after 4 years of dynamics. Let me put it that way. Developmental agenda is largely lacking, and any future plans to vitalize the economy will have to face overvalued exchange rate, as I said, corruption, uneven playing field, and weak property rights. Those are all important for development, as we know. It really is unclear what potential sources of growth could be going forward. Assuming the same level of governance, political polarization, and disengagement of the diaspora, which in normal circumstances may have acted as a catalyst for foreign investment and human capital inflow. Going forward, I still am optimistic. I think there are reasons for that, and typically my counterfactuals are as follows. I look back in early 90s, and I see that the country has come out of the most terrible crisis possible, and actually showed significant progress. I see still sizable human capital and strong commitment both inside Armenia's public as well as in a diaspora, new and old, and I'd like to emphasize the new diaspora, and just seeing the experience of Georgia that have essentially eradicated the retail corruption at least in a very short period of time. My bottom line is that I think with a clean political leadership that can help tap into the pool of physical capital and talent both inside and outside of Armenia, a technocratic government that understands how the economy functions and leads the way, and a strong public buy-in, there's practically no limit to what the economy can achieve in a reasonable period of time, despite the constraints that are imposed by geography and security, as I mentioned in the beginning. But unfortunately, we're not there yet, and time is running out quickly. A short fix for some of these things, well, and my last comments on this, I think the Armenia needs to depoliticize its economic decision-making and just build a vision and a development-intensive policy capacity to get there. Thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you very much, David. We'll turn now to Georgia. Vladimir Papava, I think he's well-known to most people in a room like this, and I'm looking forward to what you have to say, Vladimir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues. I want to speak about economic wave which was passed by Georgia during the last 20 years. The first step, they were very difficult because there were done a lot of mistakes. It was resulted in a sharp decline of economy, hyperinflation, and inflation rate was mounted 50-70% a month. And it was really a very difficult period in Georgia's economy, but starting from 1994, Georgia government established a program with supported by the International Monetary Fund, and as a result, Georgia managed to achieve macroeconomic stability, to stop hyperinflation. It was perfect background for currency reform, and in 1995, the Georgian currency lari was introduced, and it was the main achievement of economic reforms in the 90s. Before the Rose Revolution, Shevardnadze's government managed to accumulate a lot of unresolved problems, like unpaid salaries and pensions from salaries to budgetary sector, unpaid pensions, and it was a huge amount of money which was received by the population. Despite the budgetary crisis, it was another hardship to Georgia. It was an energy crisis because during winter time it was not electricity supply. And behind all these problems, it was a corruption, high-level corruption in all levels of government. As soon as the revolutionaries wins and they became in the top of the country, they started some very impressive reforms. And first of all, the main goal of them was to fight against the corruption. And it was done quite successfully. About patrol police, it's the case of Georgia is quite well known. Combat of corruption in the energy sector promote Georgia to overcome from the energy crisis, and with the winter of 2006-2007 was the first winter after a long period when it was nearly 100% of energy supply. During 1 year, 2004, Georgian government managed to double budgetary incomes and to establish political order. So it's also promote to pay unpaid liabilities. Reduction of another very impressive reform were done in the case of the business. They managed to reduce the different number of licenses and permissions. So now in Georgia, it's quite easy to start business. And again, these reforms are very well known. And finally, it's also very important to be stressed that it was a cutting of tax rates. A new tax code was established in 2005. And I give you several examples, like before, according to the old tax code, there were different 20 different types of taxes, and according to new, it was only 7. So it was 3 times decreasing of different taxes, types of taxes, and also tax rates were cutting. Like, for example, VAT tax was before it was 20%. According to new tax code, it's only 18%. Social tax was abolished. Income tax was 20%. After revolution, it became 12%. So there were very impressive reforms, positive reforms. And at the same time, there were done some institutional errors. Different agencies were closed. Many experienced people lost their jobs. New guys, very smart guys, well-educated guys, found their jobs in the government. But unfortunately, they still don't have enough experience to work with governmental agencies. And unfortunately, the institutional memory was lost. Another problem is related with institutional destruction. Like, for example, it was destroyed anti-monopoly services because it was explained that Georgia is a small country, open country, so Georgia has to have all competition. So no restrictions. That's why it's not necessary to have any institution which look on monopolies inside the country. But as a result, for example, in 2007, President Saakashvili gave order to the Minister of Interior Affairs to control monopolies first in salt market and then later in sugar market, which is institutionally a mistake. Then, or another case, when in 2006, after Russia closed a market, its market to Georgia wine, President Saakashvili gave order to the Minister of Defense to push to promote exports of Georgian wine abroad. As a result, Department of Agriculture was established inside of the Ministry of Defense. Now, shortly about transformation of corruption. Many Georgians, for them, if you ask about corruption, answer is primitive because they think that corruption is only related with bribing. So fighting against of corruption really resulted in positive, it was a real positive results when Georgian officials, they don't need, they're afraid, and they don't need to take bribes. So there is no bribing. But it does not mean that that corruption is also absent. Unfortunately, new schemes of corruption appear in Georgia, and it creates so-called elite corruption. I give you some examples. For after Rose Revolution, some extra-budgetary funds were, extra-budgetary accounts were opened, and former officials, they were obliged to spend money, to put money in these extra-budgetary accounts. So later they shift to the business, and only after this the IMF and the World Bank, they were very strong against of these extra-budgetary funds, and so during more than two years, such funds were operating. Then still is the so-called voluntary contributions, used the schemes of voluntary contributions, when businessmen obliged to spend to finance different governmental events. Then controlling the business, deprivatization and non-transparent privatization, when winners of tenders are companies, firms which were established as usually 1 week or 2 weeks before the tender was announced. Unfortunately, in Georgia, there are many cases of violation of property rights and demolishing of different private-owned residential houses. For me, it was a real very strange that there was not any criticism coming from the international financial institutions like the IMF and the World Bank. So they prefer not to criticize Georgia in violation of property rights. Now, briefly about involvement of Russia in Caucasus. First, it was briefly about liberal empire. It was a doctrine which was established in 2003. And as we know that many entities in Armenia are already controlled by Russian companies. Later, after Rose Revolution, door for Russian companies were opened in Georgia as well, which was again very strange for me. And there are many cases how Russian companies controlled Georgian different different entities in energy sector, in banking sector. And again, after war, the situation was not changed. For example, in May this year, Georgian government sold two hydropower stations to Interau, Russian energy company, and they also issued a license to for construction of three new hydropower stations. So electricity sector is not purely, but quite strongly controlled by Russians. Now, briefly about economic crisis, impact of the global financial crisis. As you know, after Russian aggression, international community decided to help Georgia, and there was conference in Brussels November 22nd, 2008, and Georgia was pledged $4.5 billion, which is a huge amount for a small Georgia, and this $4.5 billion does not include additionally $1 billion, which was granted by from the IMF, and the $2 billion from this 4.5 is the grant. So it's promote Georgia to resolve the problem with crisis hardships. So that's why I call this phenomenon as a paradox of war, because war itself is a terrible event. But it's, in the case of Georgia, war gave some fruits because Georgia received such a huge package of financial support. Now I briefly want to touch the problem about myths on Georgia's economy, which are circulated worldwide. First of all, myth about Georgia is a country of no liberal reforms. Yes, Georgia is a country of neoliberal reforms, and I already have mentioned that different licenses and permissions were abolished, and now it's quite easy to start business. But at the same time, there are many cases of violation of property rights. So it was can tell you that now Georgia's facade is neoliberal, but content of Georgian economy is neo-Bolshevik. So it's a combination of neoliberalism and neo-Bolshevism in the case of Georgia. Second myth is that Georgia, a country of free of corruption. I have already spoke about it. So unfortunately, we still face elite corruption. Third myth is about the Georgia, a country with no economic relations with Russia, which is not true. There are many Russian companies operating in Georgia, and Georgians are living in Russia, and if you look official statistical data of the National Bank of Georgia, 56% of transfer remittances are coming from Russia. So, and if you look on trade partners, Russia is a number fifth trade partner, still number fifth trade partner. And we know that at the same time, Russia's market is closed for Georgian wine, mineral water, and other agricultural goods. Fourth myth about the Georgia as a country of European orientation. Yes, officially we, on a level of articulation, we are a European-oriented country. But the main challenge for Georgia is to reach free trade agreement with the European Union, and the first significant step was done by Brussels in 2008. But there are still nothing was done in this direction. In February this year, 2011, President Saakashvili, in his speech in the parliament, has stressed that Georgia will have free trade agreement only in 2015. I really don't understand why I don't need to fulfill Brussels conditionality for reaching free trade agreement, because this conditionality is not, they are quite easy to be achieved. But if you will, there will be some questions, I'll give you my comments on it. Now, the ways of development. There are three major ways. Rapprochement with the European Union. And at the same time, Saakashvili liked to speak about Singaporeization of Georgia's economy. In the same speech in February 2011, Saakashvili mentioned that in 2017, Georgia will have Singaporean type of economy. So there is two different models in 2015, free trade agreement with the European Union, and in 2017, Singaporeization of Georgia's economy, which is impossible to achieve simultaneously. And third way is involvement into Russia's liberal empire. And what it means when you have this package of three different ways, it means that Georgia's way to nowhere. Unfortunately, it's my final words. Thank you.
Thank you, Vladimir. Yeah, I can tell those who have heard Vladimir or read his works always have a certain expectations about snappy phrases, and you didn't disappoint. That was another excellent presentation. Thank you very much, and very much within our time limits, which is great, because I know there are going to be a lot of questions. So finally, let me turn to Dr. Mamuka Tsereteli. Good. Dr. Tsereteli is from American University and the American Georgia
Business Council. Please.
Okay, thanks again for the invitation. Wonderful panel. I'll be very short, very brief in my comments. And I'll focus mostly on different aspects of private sector development. But, some of these issues that are presented on this slide were already covered. To answer initial opening question of Clifford about was there a transition in these countries in the last 20 years, despite pessimistic statements of my colleague and friend, Dr. Papawa, I would like to say that I think, yes, countries still went through transition. They, we've heard from earlier from our colleagues about growth in GDP per capita, performance in different areas of economic reforms. Obviously, 20 years, it's a long time, at the same time, it's a very short period of time to get economy intact, to solve all the problems, all the legacy issues of Soviet, both mentality and economic structure and so forth. I see last 20 years as a upward positive movement with lots of bumps on the road, lots of kind of ups and downs, but still as a positive movement towards better future. But key problem that I would like to focus today is unemployment. And this issue is shared by all three countries on a different level and different scale, but still, they all share this major problem. And I would like to use, with the permission of Hans, Caucasus Research Resource Center's few slides. Look at this slide, which is answer to question, do you have a job? And if you look at Georgia, only 30% answer yes. In Azerbaijan, 39%. In Armenia, 38%. I will explain why that's the case. But by the way, these survey results coincide with and intact with the survey of NDI and other survey institutions in Caucasus. So it's a reliable data. And it reflects perceptions of people about whether they have or not job. So look at numbers. And I can explain why I think that's the case. At least in Georgian statistics, I'm sure that's the case with other countries as well. If you have a parcel of land, you are considered to be employed. If you buy bread at the bakery and go in the street, some older lady or gentleman buys bread at bakery and goes to the street and resells it with a 5, maybe 10 cent profit, person is considered to be employed. So official statistics sees these people as employed while they don't see themselves as employed. And perception of most of the people is that job is when you go to the job in the morning and come back in the evening, and at some point you get the paycheck. So that's not a reality in this country. Only, as you can see, a minor fraction of society is involved in that type of economic activity. There are some other kind of interesting details here. Not enough money for food. All three countries are about the same level. Enough money for food, but not for clothes. And if you look at the enough money for food and clothes, but not for the durable, and you constitute 95% of population, almost. So serious social problems. So trends of unemployment. If you look at, despite all the numbers of growth, particularly the last 10 years in all three countries, Georgia averaged 8%, Armenia and Azerbaijan, nearly 13%. You can see that unemployment numbers are very high, both official and unofficial. And why that's the case? And let's look at the kind of key obstacles of job creation. I think one of the major issues, major problems, is governments still treat businesses as a source of revenue, not a factor of development and job creation. It's true that let's take case of Georgia. It's true that taxes are rates are reduced. It's also true that many obstacles, barriers towards incorporation or other kind of obstacles were abolished. But still, if you are in business and if you have profit and if you are successful, we have lots of problems in relationships with the government, mostly on taxation issues, and sometimes some other agencies are getting involved in those relationships. All three countries have problems with the judiciary system. If you look at, let's say, World Competitiveness Report, and I'll talk a little bit later on this ranking, all three countries ranked below 100 in that that ranking in terms of judicial independence. They are also below 100 on property rights respect. So that's a major issue. And if you have a case against government, it's almost impossible to win case, even if you are completely right. Informal engagement in government officials in business deals, written rules are different from realities. I mean, this is a big problem that, you know, World Bank, through doing business, created a wonderful scheme. If you write good regulations, you will be top reformer in the world. But how those reforms are implemented in reality, that's a key question. And there's a huge gap between realities and those written rules. And in general, governments treat free entrepreneurship as a threat to themselves, not a source of really development or freedom or growth. And that's one of the key problems as well. You know, in order to change situation and improve environment and actually grow, it's impossible to grow without investment from both domestic and foreign sources. And if you look at statistics, Azerbaijan definitely is way ahead of its neighbors. It has, if you look at the kind of average numbers, it performed about the level of Eastern European countries, but 88% of this investments, foreign direct investments, went to oil sector. So it really doesn't help this unemployment issue, doesn't help technology transfer or other kind of developmental elements issues. Okay, so we know that these rankings, I've just mentioned them. I mean, if you look at, let's say, Azerbaijan was ranked in 2009 as the top reformer, number 33 at that year. Georgia in 2010 was 12, it's 16th in 2012 rankings. Armenia was also performing well. And these rankings actually indicate, once you look to economic freedom rankings, it's very impressive numbers. And then again, World Competitiveness Report presents a slightly different picture. Why that's a case, why Azerbaijan, let's say, is doing better than Georgia and Armenia in GSI index is because size of economy and GDP and other macroeconomic numbers matter there. While in the key indicators that describe the business environment, all three countries are about the same level, meaning the property right, judicial independence, and so forth. So now, in order to, in this environment, under this local regional picture kind of development, we should also look at what is the kind of background, what is the global environment where these countries need to compete with other countries in terms of attracting foreign direct investments. And so let me go through kind of few points here. Of course, financial crisis, and it's a blessing and curse at the same time. If you think about this country, United States, there are about between $2 and $3 trillion in private funds, banks, private investors. Funds are available for investments, and if there were right environment, attractive environment in countries around the world, some of this money would definitely go to be invested. And I think the Caucasus is one of the areas for destination. Despite all the problems we described here, there is a still big, large opportunities. Large opportunities meaning that assets are still undervalued. If you look, let's say, price of land, price of properties, still, sometime from 20% to 30% to 40% of the world prices. I'm not talking about downtown Baku and Tbilisi right now or Yerevan. I'm talking about in general in agricultural areas and rural areas, small towns, and so forth. And there are opportunities, obviously, in economic for foreign direct investments in different aspects of foreign direct investments. And we can talk about those maybe later. Factor of Russia and Turkey. Dr. Papava mentioned remittances. All three countries get tremendous remittances from Russia. And Russia, despite all the kind of political and other kind of tensions between some countries, remains the key and very important economic player, actor in this region. Geostrategic picture is also important because if when U.S. troops are removed from Afghanistan, importance of region will change. Probably level of attention, geopolitical attention to level may decrease unless there is another war. Hopefully not. That's a kind of reality given to us that we need to consider as well. That how much, let's say, transit will go through Central Asia for U.S. bases in Afghanistan and Kyrgyzstan and other places and so forth. So region needs to prepare itself for the different geopolitical realities. I have not mentioned Turkey. Turkey is a very essential trade partner for South Caucasus. I think that's also given almost the same level as Russia. And I think European Union again, it was mentioned here that how important, I mean, with the Eastern Partnership programs and some other programs and some desire we hear for the last three years that there is a intention to do this deep and comprehensive free trade agreement with the European Union. In Georgian case, for the last 3 years, every official who comes to town here tells us that next year we are going to start deep and comprehensive free trade agreement negotiations, and so far we don't see that happening. So this, I think, again, relationship with European Union, free trade agreements with the European Union and some other key economic powers of the world would give assurances for foreign investors, as well as domestic investors, that investing in these countries is long-term endeavor and long-term initiative, and that brings assurances of stability to those investors. I think to complete my presentation. By the way, this is a pipeline maps of the region. It just looks good. That's why I put it here. And. I think key challenge, but it's not only economic challenge, unemployment. To deal with unemployment, all three countries really need to make very serious efforts. And mostly, it's also on a government level, way government currently treats private businesses and way it looks at business as a source of revenue, not a source of growth and development. That has to be changed. And then, hopefully, with other ingredients in place, like attraction of foreign direct investments, also investments that could come from citizens of Georgia and Armenia and Azerbaijan, that should help improvements in economic environment and job situation. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Okay, that
was a wonderful rounding out of the previous
contribution. So now we
can open up, and I would like, I'll just start at the front and move to the back, but please, before you pose your question, if you could introduce yourself, it would be very helpful. So I'll start at this table here, and then I'll move back on that side. The microphone, please.
My question is to Vladimir Popava. You seem to be very pessimistic about Georgia's economic development and prospects for its economic development. But one thing that you appear to be somewhat optimistic is what you called paradox of war, that Georgia actually, according to you, gained financially by getting international aid money, 4.5 billion. My question is how substantiated is this argument, considering especially the fact that before the war, Georgia attracted lots of investments all the way from Kazakhstan, from Middle East countries, from Europe, from United States. And after the war, all the international investments, most of the international investments have gone away. And Georgia still could not recuperate from that shock. So would you call it still a paradox of war that Georgia allegedly gained from the war financially, or you would not agree with this argument?
Vladimir, would you like to briefly respond to this? We'll respond to each question in turn as long as we don't run into trouble with time, and then I'll start collecting them together. So if both the questioners and the responders could be brief, we'll move through.
Thank you for this question. I am not a pessimistic. I am a realist. It's first. Then now about investments. You are right that mostly investments came from Russia, Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan, from Arabic world. But there are only single cases of Western investments in Georgian reality. So that's why I have mentioned that Georgia is very attractive for Russian business and some post-Soviet type investments. And now what's happened after Russian aggression, after the war? The attractiveness of Georgia decreased because only 25 kilometers is from Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, Russian tanks are located. So when 20% of Georgia's territory is occupied, it's not a positive message. It's really bad message for investors to put money, to spend money in Georgia. And then still we have face very aggressive articulation from both sides, Moscow and Tbilisi. And this articulation, for example, President Saakashvili several times mentioned that Georgia lost only struggle, but war is still on the way. So if there are such statements, then it's a very bad message for investors. And also have to mention about the structure of investments, because mostly investments which inflowed before the Russian aggression, they were focused on real estate. So it was really speculative investment, not to promoting economic development of real sector of economy. Now about the paradox of war. Several times President Saakashvili mentioned that Georgia is a successful country, that global financial crisis avoid Georgia, that this crisis destroyed all our neighbors, developed countries, but Georgia is successful. Yes, Georgia was successful because Georgia received huge package of this amount of money. And 1 month ago, Minister of Finance of Georgia, he made a statement that nearly 40% of this 4.5 billion is still allocated in the treasury, not already spent. So it's a good financial support not to feel some difficulties in nearest future.
At the second table, there was a, no, right behind you there.
Ali Laliva, Azerbaijan. My question is to Inglab Akhmedov. Thank you very much for your overview of Azerbaijan economy. I'm interested in relations between the oil industry and market economy. I mean, one of the greatest incentives or factors which boosted market economy in the 19th century of Azerbaijan was privatization of the oil industry, oil assets or different parts of the oil industry, refineries. And it gave a major boost because of the reforms in the oil industry. First, as I said, a privatization, and second, creation of the competitive environment in the oil industry. I understand we're speaking about totally different environments. There were no transnational companies at that time. I know that in 1992, the Popular Front government was planning to privatize the oil company. I was wondering, do you think that privatization and of the oil company, state oil company, would make things different? And could you speculate on this scenario? If that was done as it was planned by the Popular Front government in 1992, how would it look like in relations? Because we started our basically oil exploration and development before the market economy was established. And that apparently had a tremendous impact on the further development also. I was wondering whether maybe privatization of the oil company and then going public will have a similar effect, would have a similar effect? Thank you.
Good, thank you.
Thank you for your question. Unfortunately, it's not so correctly to have some parallel between first oil boom, which was early in the 20th century, and current situation, because it's absolutely different environment, different, you know, the historical period, and different, how to say, the factor for that. I had some positive approach that if in 1996-97, which was very promising years for Azerbaijan, the first years of Haider Aliyev, Paula, when we started, you know, the massive privatization of many sectors, and we promised that we will start oil sector privatization also, maybe that will be some challenging, some momentum stimulus for oil sector development, which will have some different scenarios, mostly more positive rather than today we have. But the situation is that the problem is not just privatization. Privatization is tool, no more. Fundamental situation, unfortunately, changed since 1998 when all of economy segments, you know, the step by step was controlled, and actually we have all of segments controlled by power, by authority, by government. So oil is not the exception, and particularly the exception, no exception, because it's a much more important sector. I'm not sure that that scenario will be possible, and then we will have different picture. I think we should have, because it's very logical in terms of government decisions since 1998 and by now. So I'm not so optimistic in terms of privatization scenarios for oil and oil sector and some positive results on that.
Thank you very much. In front of you there is, yes.
Thank you. I'm Victoria Kupchanetsky, Voice of America. And my question is to each of the members of the distinguished panel, if possible. At some point, Vladimir Putin called the dissolution, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the greatest geopolitical catastrophe. What is your, in your opinion, was it a catastrophe or was it a blessing to each of your countries, economically speaking? And if we look at the quality of life of citizens in Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia nowadays, are they living better than they were living in the Soviet Union, or worse? Thank you.
Well, yeah. Okay, we'll let everybody. hope you can answer this briefly. So, is Putin right or wrong?
It's definitely a blessing. And it's a blessing for many different reasons, but primary reason is that if you look at the citizens of look at this room, how many Georgians, Armenians, Azerbaijanis, they are freely traveling now. They are enjoying understanding of the world. They are enjoying the best achievements of the world. Not everyone is able to travel. There are still hardships in our home countries. But as I said earlier, if you look at the trajectory of development, trajectory is positive. And after 20 years, when we already passed 40 years, this biblical number, we'll be much, much better off. So mentality of politicians will change, their treatment of their people, their businesses and so forth will change. And if we stayed in Soviet Union, we had to go another 40 years after it would collapse at some point anyways. So that's my short answer.
I also want to continue. I agree with Dr. Tsaratelli that the collapse of Soviet Union was blessing not only for our countries but for Russians as well. It's first of all, they need to understand this blessing for them to have all possibilities of their economic development. Now about economic hardships. Economic hardships we faced not because of collapse of the Soviet Union, but because of our own mistakes. So we have to compare. We have to compare the situation of our not with Soviet time, but with other countries like East European countries now who are the members of the European Union. Why we are still far from these countries? Why we don't have success in our reforms? And it's not because of the collapse, because of disappearance of Soviet Union. Soviet Union was not efficient economy, so it cannot give fruitful results for not only Caucasian countries, but for Russians as well.
Thank you.
Just a couple of words. I'm not sure that we have to identify like blessing, no blessing. But I have to say that Soviet economy was artificial. It was not natural economy. And it was absolutely reasonable that more or less we will have end of this economy as we had it in early 90s. You can just compare couple of economies within unique nations, like two German economies, two Chinese economies, Hong Kong and China, two Korean economies. It's very good argument to say that it's Soviet economy was just, you know, it's a question of time. So I absolutely agree with my colleagues.
I'll second what my fellow panelists have said. I think it was a blessing. It was a wonderful opportunity for Armenia to regain its sovereignty. The question is whether we've used that opportunity well enough or not. And I think on that I've spoken already.
Great, thank you. Yes, right there.
Yael Levine, Eurasia Group. I was wondering about the disconnect between the political and the economic cooperation between Russia and Georgia that you were describing, Dr. Papava. I wonder whether the WTO accession will matter going forward, and also if the Georgian economy has truly recovered, doesn't need the Russian market, or if that would be a huge benefit for Georgia going forward to have trade with Russia increase. And to what extent is that already happening? Sort of, you were talking about this disconnect. What has been the trajectory? What is the future trajectory, sort of independent of Saakashvili and political rhetoric?
Very good.
Thank you. The problem is really about differences in political and economic relations between Georgia and Russia. But the problem related with WTO was, I think that it was resolved in a very fruitful way for both sides, for Russia and for Georgia as well. Because for Georgia, it's very important to have Russia inside of the WTO, which will be a more predictable trader. And Russia is a huge market, and for Georgia it's very important to return to Russian market for Georgian economy, but I don't know when it will happen, and it will be combined with Russian accession to WTO or not, because there are still the problem coming from Russian sanitary inspectorate. So if Georgian company will manage to return to Russian market, it will be perfect. But anyway, we Georgian economy shows that we can survive without accessing to returning to Russian market. Now, the consensus which was initiated by Switzerland, which it really was the position of Georgian government before a couple of months ago. So it was perfect that this framework was established not by Georgian government, but by third side, Switzerland government. So now it's allow Georgia and Russia to have some formal framework where we can discuss again the problem of returning Georgian agricultural goods to Russian market. And without this framework, it was impossible to have any real communication between these two governments.
Thank you very much. Let's have a question here at the first table.
Alex van Oss, Foreign Service Institute. My question is about the building industry and quality of construction. A few years ago, Azerbaijan International Magazine had a very dramatic series of cover story articles about the building boom in Baku, and that buildings were going up made with inferior cement and concrete. Cracks were developing as they dried, and that when concerned families living next door or dispossessed and having to move out from one of these buildings to go up, inquired about this, they were told, don't get involved. They're high up people, you know, better keep quiet. This was a few years ago. I wonder if you can shed light on this situation. Is it true, not, given that there is so much building going on in the Caucasus, and given that it's an earthquake zone?
Thank you.
Just shortly, yeah, exactly. It's construction boom we had, particularly before global crisis, but actually we have it maybe less growing, but anyway, we have it clearly. Why? It's easily. As oil economy, we have much more advantage for services, for so-called non-tradable goods, which is construction. And we have money, we don't have competitiveness for manufacturing and other sectors. So in this case, very, you know, the logical, you know, the result which we have when it's Baku and also, you know, provinces had a huge program on construction, both state and private sector. The problem is, we don't have any competitiveness and any linkage between construction boom and demand on that from real market side. Unfortunately, sometimes it's like, you know, oligarchic money which engaged to this partly corrupt money for these businesses, for some, I don't know, some virtual ideas, not for real market and, you know, demand supply issue. So it's a case, and we actually, after global crisis, you know, the gradually again booming, I think that will be for some years real, you know, picture for us.
Great. Right there at the table in the orange.
Thank you very much. My name is Inge Snip. I'm a visiting scholar at the Harriman Institute at Columbia University. I had a question, but it's sort of already answered, but I still would like to go on it. And then I have a second question, which is more empirical and not very theoretical. It's about, and I will start with that one, talking about the funding that Georgia got. So my questions are both Georgia-related. The funding that Georgia got from outside, the billions, and talking about property rights and the reconstruction of old Tbilisi and the investments going on in Batumi at the moment, what amount of the money is like, is that kind of money, are those billions being used for the reconstruction? And if not, who is funding these reconstructions? Who is funding the investments in the buildings that are coming up in Batumi? I've been wondering about this, and I haven't really found out like who exactly is behind this, because it's been like so rapidly after the war. And then my second question goes about political rhetoric and the relationship between Russia and Georgia, and mostly about Saakashvili's recent comment when he fired the head of the Samtres, the wine department of the agricultural department of the Georgian government. He fired the guy because he said he was very dissatisfied with the wine export, but in the same speech he also said that he didn't want to hear anything about Russia ever again. So how do you place this, like, you know, sort of like discrepancy between what he wants and what he says? Because obviously opening up the wine market with Russia would be amazing for Georgia's export of its wines. Thank you very much.
Thank you. First of all, who is funding such construction? It was a serious question, not only for you, but for me as well, because we received huge amount of money, and it was a problem when, soon after the war, Saakashvili announced that his goal is to construct a new building in Kutaisi, which is in western Georgia. So it was very surprisable, because we have building of the parliament in the center of Tbilisi, and why he decided to spend money when we received the grant. So, and what was interesting for me is that there was not any spent inside of the national budget on the construction. But it was done transfer from central budget to local budget of city Kutaisi, and it was funded by local budget. So if donors look what's happened inside the national budget, there is no funds, no expenditures on construction for the Kutaisi in parliament. But if you then look in local budget, then it is allocated for money. So there are many research done in this topic, and they show that some of such huge construction are promoted by business. I already mentioned so-called voluntary contribution, participation of construction. As it resulted in increasing of prices, goods which they are supplied, like in pharmaceutical business, in gasoline business. So there are funding coming from central budget, but by transfer to local budget and from the businessmen as well. Now about the returning of Georgian wine. It's really very interesting question because there were done several statements by President Saakashvili, Minister of Foreign Affairs, later by the Minister of Economy, that Georgia will not return to Russian market. Market, that it's a market with high risk, which everybody knows worldwide. And, for example, Minister of Economy made a statement that before we will not return our occupied territory, Georgian wine will not export it to Russia, which is very strange for me because the Minister of Economy is against of promotion of exports, first of all. And second, how we can explain that we allow Georgians to live in Russia and to send remittances and not to allow Georgian wine to be exported in Russian market. At the same time, business which is under the control, they also, businessmen, they are afraid to express the vision about returning of Georgian market. But I think step by step, it's a problem of business. So they will have now some legal framework on the basis of the WTO, but I'm not very optimistic that they will do it in nearest future and that it will be some successful deal.
I think just a matter of time. It's probably, we are talking about from 6 months to 2 years after all election cycles are over in Georgia and Russia, the Georgian wines will be back to Russian market.
Gentleman over there at the table.
Emil Danielian, Armenia. My question is to Mr. Akhmadov. You said in your presentation, you mentioned the scale of labor migration from Azerbaijan to Russia in the 1990s and the importance of remittances coming from those migrant workers. Have many of those people returned home during these oil boom years? Thank you.
So, unfortunately, we don't have any clear picture on that statistics because it's very, you know, the informal, it's not so official moving and registration, all of this moving. But so the situation was like, you know, the before or so it related to crisis and economy situation in Russia itself. So it was one very favorable period for this group of people before 1998 when, you know, crisis was started in Russia. That was very terrible for this group of people and remittance was dramatically declined. And after that, we had some problem with this remittance volume and gradually that was, you know, the growth. And before global crisis, we had good favorable picture in Azerbaijan when city engaged many, I mean Baku, engaged many workers from the provinces. Why? That was very good conjecture in terms of construction sector and, you know, the involving people. And then the moving to Russia was declined. And after when we had the problem with construction sector in Azerbaijan, again people removed to Russia. So it's some, you know, the interlinked situation, but mostly it's around, as I mentioned, it's around 1.5 million people, which have, you know, the sometimes families in that in Russia. Sometimes they moved and remittance for Azerbaijan is very important. But again, I would say that it's very significant size of money, which has the, I think the, you know, very remarkable role on family incomes in particularly in province.
Thank you. We have time for a couple more questions. I hate to rule out all the people at the back there, but it's very difficult to see, so I kind of just keep moving backward. But there's a lady there in black, and there's a microphone right there, so why don't you ask your question?
Thank you very much. My name is Sabine Fischer from the European Union Institute for Security Studies. Thank you very much for four very interesting presentations. My question goes to the panel. I think it has become clear from the presentations that Russia and also, for instance, Turkey play a very important role for trade and economic relations in the South Caucasus. But could you perhaps say a few words about intra-regional trade and economic relations? What is the state there? How have they developed in the past, whatever, 10, 20 years? What is your assessment of that? And to take that a little bit further, Do you think that intra-regional trade and economic relations could have the potential in the medium and long term to improve the political climate in the region? Very briefly, DCFTA negotiations between the European Union and Georgia are scheduled to start at the end of this year in parallel with the negotiations with Armenia and Azerbaijan. So at least some progress in that respect. And a very quick question to Vladimir Papava. Do you think that the WTO compromise between Georgia and Russia, do you think that could be an opening for an improvement of the situation or the economic relations between Georgia and Russia? Thank you very much.
Well, let me ask Vladimir to quickly respond to that. I think you kind of addressed that. But then I would like, and maybe that'll have to be the end, let each of the participants, the panelists, comment on that very good question about intra-regional economic relations, and that probably will be the wrap-up for this panel. But Vladimir, quickly on this WTO.
Yes, first of all, the WTO is only framework for cooperation, but it does not, it's not a medicine to promote, to really improve the situation. It's dependent on political elite of both countries and business elite as well. Now, about interregional trade. Yes, Georgia, Azerbaijan is very important strategic economic partner, but you know that there is no legal trade relations between Azerbaijan and Armenia, but there are some trade relations via Georgia, unofficial, as usually, but they are, as usual, published in different articles related on this topic. So I think that it's quite stable, at least Georgia-Azerbaijani relations. It's also very promising Georgia-Armenian relations, because for Armenia it's also very important to have access to Western direction. And in Georgia's interest to resolve all the problems inside of the region. And I hope that it will have such a very promising future, the international trade inside Caucasus. Now, WTO I've already mentioned. Thank you.
Okay. David, let me ask you you haven't had a chance to say very much here, and I know that this could be quite an interesting issue for you.
Indeed. I think sort of the trade issues have been sort of overarching for Armenia's policymakers in the past few years. And you know, I have my own views on that, but largely skeptical of what has been sort of done. But I think in a nutshell, I think that the promise of trade is just as good as underlying competitiveness. I think, for that reason that I think inter-regional trades carry a much bigger promise than the trade outside of this region. I think Armenian agri-processing sector and some of the services in mid to late 90s have been very successful attracting Georgian buyers and infiltrating into the Georgian market. But unfortunately, that trend has that turned into a situation where more capital is flowing now to Georgia from Armenia as opposed to goods. And as far as our Armenia-Azerbaijan trade, there are no statistics on that. And as my panelists mentioned, I think that whatever volume of that takes place, that takes place through Georgia. I think my advice to all of those who are looking for sort of silver bullet and trade should be that trade and rather promise of trade is not about only access. Because remember, transportation cost is just a part of cost structure, just one element of competitiveness. What's relevant is ability to export, ability to trade. And if that's not there, forget it. And that there are ample of evidence where liberalizing markets, opening barriers to trade have actually led to loss of market share. I'll leave it at that.
Excellent. Very good. Professor Akhmadov, would you like to comment on that?
Generally or regarding to
on the intra-regional trade?
So my colleagues, they clarified this issue. Really, we have good relationship in terms of Georgian and Azerbaijan trade. You know, we have investment in this country. We have our, the oil and non-oil trades with Georgian. With Armenia, it's absolutely understandable that we cannot have any trade relationship because we cannot that. So trade is something like follow-up of the economy relationship. We have to have as robust as possible, as clear as possible economy relationship between our countries. And in case of Armenia, as everybody can imagine, it depends on the resolution of the conflict. That will be a clear picture in terms of, you know, the fasting this trade relationship and to have more effective and more beneficial situation for each of our countries.
Thank you. And finally, Dr. Tertelli.
Yeah, two quick points. One is that, unfortunately, a conflict that exists in the region between Armenia and Azerbaijan, this is the probably the biggest obstacle, not for just these two countries, but for entire region to be developing much faster rate and to be absorbed by a larger kind of economic space of Turkey and the rest of the Europe. And but this is the case when actually trade will not help to resolve the conflict. It has to be resolved first before trade will occur between Azerbaijan and Armenia. And on the internal dynamics of region, I think my Azerbaijani colleague presented very impressive numbers on GDP in Azerbaijan comparable to GDP of Georgia and Armenia. If you take into consideration population and population trends and growth, there is a very interesting dynamics emerging in the region when Azerbaijan actually starting to dominate economic environment. Azerbaijan already controls, owns ports on the Black Sea. Almost all, the majority of the gas stations in Georgia are owned by SOCAR. Many other businesses you see now, real estate developed by Azerbaijani companies and so forth. Azerbaijan plays larger, increasingly larger role in the Georgian economy. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Well, that brings us to the end of this session. I hope everyone will join me in thanking the panelists for very informative and balanced presentations. And I think the panelists will join me in thanking you for some very good questions. It allowed us to cover a lot of ground. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd also like to thank Cliff for chairing that panel.